This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. When Edward Snowden was ready to leak classified documents he'd stolen from the National Security Agency, the first journalist he contacted was our guest, Glenn Greenwald. Snowden knew of him through Greenwald's coverage of the NSA warrantless wiretapping scandal on his blog and in a book. Snowden said he believed Greenwald could be counted on to understand the dangers of mass surveillance and not to back down in the face of government pressure. The first story Greenwald broke from the Snowden documents was about how the government collects metadata from telecom companies, including the metadata of calls made by people in the U.S. Ever since publication, Snowden and Greenwald have been at the center of controversies about whistleblowing and journalistic ethics. Greenwald's written a new book that tells the story of how he met Snowden, explains the editorial decisions he made, and analyzes the revelations contained in some of the leaked documents. It's called No Place to Hide. He spoke with Terry last Wednesday.
Glenn Greenwald, welcome to Fresh Air. Are you confident you're going to make it through the book tour without being arrested?
At this point, I'm reasonably confident. There was clearly an attempt by the part of national security officials and U.S. government officials at a high level to create an area or of uncertainty about whether we could safely return to the U.S. But since I came back 3 weeks ago for the George Polk Awards and nothing happened, I feel reasonably confident that nothing will.
Are you traveling with security and legal counsel?
I have legal counsel that is ready in the event they're needed in all of the cities I'm visiting, both here and in Europe. And security is also an issue that has been taken care of. But, I mean, once you know, it's with all risks. I mean, you should be aware of them. You should take reasonable precautions to guard against them and then sort of put them out of your mind. And that's what I'm trying to do.
I don't want to dwell too much on the security or make you paranoid, but, you know, in addition to your concerns about possibly being put up on criminal charges for what you published, well, are you concerned about that there might be criminal charges?
Well, you know, as I said, I mean, the U.S. government, you know, beginning with President Obama's senior national security official, James Clapper, Keith Alexander, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, have all publicly said that they think the journalism we're doing should be criminalized, that we ought to be arrested and prosecuted, that I specifically ought to be. So there was definitely a concern for many months. And in fact, I stayed out of the U.S. in Brazil, where I live, for 10 months as I was doing the reporting and didn't return to the U.S. until just a few weeks ago, primarily due to that concern and on advice of my lawyers who were unable to get assurances from the Justice Department that nothing would happen. But since I've returned to the U.S. Without incident, I do feel confident that that's probably not on the table for them.
Are you concerned about people who are just extremists and think you need to be punished?
Sure. You know, I mean, this story has had all kinds of risk from the beginning. I mean, obviously, when you are in possession of many tens of thousands of top secret documents that every government in the world would like to get its hands on, including the United States, there are those kinds of risks. And then there are definitely risks from people who feel very strongly that the journalism you're doing is damaging or treasonous or wrong. So I think all of those risks are there. But lots of journalists face risks like that. And again, you take precautions against them and then you try and just focus on the journalism.
Thanks for clarifying approximately how many documents there are, tens of thousands. That's a lot of responsibility.
It is. It's part of what made this story, you know, so tense and intense in terms of reporting. And it's one of the things also that I think has been misunderstood about Edward Snowden, which is that, you know, he actually hasn't released a single document to the public. He could have if he wanted to. He could have uploaded the documents to the internet on his own. He could have given them to foreign powers. There are all sorts of things he could have done. And what he did instead was he came to journalists and said, I don't actually think that I, Edward Snowden, am the person who should be making the decisions about what the public should and shouldn't see. I actually think that that's journalists who ought to be making that call. And I want you to work within media organizations that have experience in making these decisions and make those judgments yourself. And you're right. There's a huge responsibility that comes from making those choices.
There's part of me that's always been wondering, why didn't Snowden release the information about some key programs, like the first programs that you wrote about, prison and the collection of metadata from the telecom companies, and say, and there's a lot more there that Congress should be exercising oversight about, as opposed to downloading tens of thousands of documents and risking that they'd get in the wrong hands. Now, I know he's a master of encryption, and he says that they are safe. But, like, in this world, I mean, who really knows what's safe?
You know, I think that is an important point that, you reference, which is that he is a highly trained operative by the NSA in the most advanced techniques for safeguarding digital information and for preventing other governments and other factions from being able to invade them. But, you know, I think the broader and more important point there is that it's hard to overstate just how impotent and neutered the congressional oversight process has become. The idea that if you're a whistleblower within the U.S. government and you discover serious abuses and you take them to the Congress and anything is going to be done, at this point is really fiction. And I think the key event to understand that is that there are two Democratic senators, Ron Wyden and Mark Udall, both of whom are on the Senate Intelligence Committee, who have been running around the United States for 3 or 4 years saying very extremist and alarmist claims about how the powers claimed by the Obama administration under the Patriot Act for surveillance are stunning, that if the American people learned about them, they would be shocked, that it goes far beyond what the law allows. And yet they didn't do what Edward Snowden did, which is tell the American public what it is that was being done. They were so constrained, even these powerful senators, that they couldn't do anything because the law silenced them. And Edward Snowden knew that and knew that the only way to get this information out was to come and work with journalists.
But still, getting to the tens of thousands of documents, it would take you a lifetime to even read those documents if there's tens of thousands, let alone pass judgment on which ones are worthy of publication and which ones it might be harmful if you published and which ones aren't really important. I mean, I still keep wondering, like, what's the motivation for downloading that many documents? And how do you intend to deal with such a massive amount?
You know, I mean, I think it's easy to overestimate the amount of time that it takes to understand what's in that number of documents. Before I was a journalist, I was a lawyer. And as a junior lawyer, like every junior lawyer, I spent a month in a conference room many times with enormous boxes of documents where you have to make decisions about which documents can be withheld, which have to be produced to the other side. You go through tens of thousands. Literally, maybe you don't read every line, but you certainly get enough of a sense of what these documents are to make decisions about them. And that's what he did before he gave them to us. And we do feel that we've gotten a handle on what all of these documents are. We've looked at them several times. We've spent many months doing it. We've had teams of reporters from around the world helping us and experts and consultants. But I think, you know, the bigger point here is that Edward Snowden does not think that there's one or two discrete programs within the NSA that are abusive and out of control. He believes the NSA system itself, the entire ubiquitous system of suspicionless surveillance, is itself inherently abusive, and that the public has a right to know, not about every detail, not about every program, but about the capabilities that this agency has developed.
I want to read something critical that was written this week in review of your book by David Cole, who's a constitutional lawyer. He's the legal affairs correspondent for the liberal publication The Nation. He's the co-author of a book called Terrorism and the Constitution, Sacrificing Civil Liberties in the Name of National Security, a book that warns against sacrificing civil liberties for national security. And so in reviewing your book, he wrote, "Some disclosures raise more questions about Greenwald's judgment than about the NSA's activities. One document, for example, identifies the specific methods used to bug 24 named foreign embassies. The document reveals top-secret methods and targets, and its disclosure is likely to undermine legitimate intelligence gathering and cause serious diplomatic problems. Yet it's difficult to see what possible value it adds to the public debate. It's one thing to disclose secret government practices that raise serious moral, political, and constitutional concerns, as many of Snowden's disclosures have done. But bugging foreign embassies is at the core of foreign intelligence, and there's nothing illegal or particularly surprising about the fact that we do it. Greenwald does not always recognize the difference between justified and unjustified disclosures." I'd be interested to hear your response to that criticism.
Well, first of all, there are lots of other media outlets besides me and my book that have reported on parts of that document. The Guardian, the New York Times, and the Washington Post have all made judgments that U.S. surveillance on allied governments of the kind that that document reveals is newsworthy and ought to be published. So I'm very comfortable with the fact that the leading American journalistic outlets have all reached the same conclusion that I did and disagree with David Cole, that that sort of information ought to be known. I would also add that people in those countries whose consulates and embassies on American soil have been invaded using very extreme forms of surveillance, not just listening in through remote devices, but literally physically invading the consulates and embassies, implanting backdoor devices on their computers in order to gather the information that their diplomats and that their officials and ambassadors are saying, not Iranian and North Korean ones, but French and Italian and German and Spanish and Brazilian, people in those countries consider that extremely newsworthy. And the extent of the United States' capabilities to invade even protected communications, these consulates and embassies are really well fortified. They use encryption. They use other forms of sophisticated means to keep people out. The ability of the NSA to invade pretty much anything that they want is a critical part of understanding what our government has developed largely in the dark so that we can debate whether or not real limits need to be imposed on it.
Do you think that the NSA has the right to spy and to keep secrets? And if so, where do you draw the line between what secrets they have the right to keep and what secrets you as a journalist have the responsibility or the right to divulge?
Sure. I mean, we were talking earlier about how Edward Snowden gave us many tens of thousands of documents, and we have published a small percentage of those, even though we've had them for close to a year now. And in fact, we've been criticized in some circles for not publishing more, for holding on to so much of the information. So clearly, I believe, and actually Edward Snowden was vehement about, the fact that not all of this information should be published, that some of this is kept secret legitimately, that the NSA has the right and the duty even to spy on Al-Qaeda and other groups that are genuinely threatening to the United States. And so the decision-making process that we've engaged in has been the one that I think journalists all over the world use every single day, which is weighing the value of the disclosure for the public interest versus the potential harm that it may have to innocent people. And I've never made a decision on my own about what should be published. I've worked with extremely experienced editors and national security reporters and my colleagues at large media institutions. We've had debates about it every day, just like journalists always do. And we've reached conclusions that we're very comfortable with, where we feel like, if anything, we've erred on the side of excess caution. I think the criticism that we've published too little is actually a more valid criticism than the one that says we've published too much.
Early in the game, when you were preparing to publish the first documents about the collection of metadata from phone companies, you put a lot of pressure on The Guardian. You know, you had recently met with Snowden in Hong Kong. You had tried your best to vet him. You thought he was for real, that he was being honest, that his motives were good motives. And you wanted to move forward. You were partnering with The Guardian. You already had a contract writing a column with them. And you were really pressuring The Guardian to, like, publish now or else you were going to publish it on your website. Why were you in such a hurry to publish?
You know, I've been a critic of U.S. media outlets for a long time, and sort of the excess caution that they, I think, exercise when reporting. Their kind of subservience to the government. There's been a lot of controversies about the New York Times sitting on information at the behest of the U.S. government. And, you know, one of the reasons why I wrote the book was because that experience in Hong Kong of going and meeting Edward Snowden in the weeks that led up to that, you know, so much has been written about it and so much of it is sort of untrue or distorted that I wanted to give people insight into what it was like to go through that, because so much of that shaped the choices that I made, including the one that you just referenced. And, you know, one of the things that I saw was this 29-year-old, previously obscure and anonymous, very kind of ordinary person, knowingly sacrificing his entire life, pretty certain that he would go to prison for decades, if not the rest of his life, in order to undertake this act of conscience to bring to the world things that he thought people should know. So watching him do that made me want to do justice to his sacrifice. And the fearlessness with which he came forward, I thought was the fearlessness that needed to drive how the reporting was done. And I was concerned that Guardian lawyers and just the standard institutional impediments that arise when you want to do something like this in a large corporation would start to infuse the reporting with fear and risk aversion and try to dilute it and neuter it. And so I very much felt an obligation to my source and to the story to make sure that The Guardian was as aggressive as I thought the story needed to be, which meant not stopping because lawyers wanted to meet for weeks with the government, but going ahead and telling the world what they clearly had a right to know. And I don't have any objection to the process itself, where as a journalist, you go to the government before you publish top secret documents, inform the government about what you intend to publish. The problem that I have is that this process has been so corrupting and corrupted that it has resulted so often in a kind of excess deference to the demands of the government that material not be published that clearly should be.
So you said you're comfortable contacting the government, telling them what you're going to publish and hearing them out. In the case of the telephone metadata collection that the NSA is doing, my understanding from your book is that The Guardian contacted government officials and basically gave them a few hours to make their case, in part because of your pressure, you know, to like publish now or else you're going to take it to your own website. So they said, like, we're going to publish today unless you convince us otherwise. And the way you describe it, it sounds like the government officials were kind of outraged at having so little time to make their case, to prepare their case, to talk to the people they'd need to talk to before making their case. And so I'm wondering, like, is that really a genuine opportunity for debate about it? Or is that just a kind of pro forma, yeah, we're consulting you, and okay, but we're going to publish it?
Right. I mean, I think different stories require different levels of discussion. There have been some stories that we've done that have involved multiple conversations over the period of several weeks with government officials because they're very complex. There are serious arguments and sensitivities that we want to understand before making choices. And so we give the government ample opportunity. We go back and forth with them and the like. With that story in particular, the first one that we reported, there was no conceivable circumstance, none at all, in which I would ever make the decision that I would suppress rather than report a story that said that the U.S. government was collecting the lists of all the telephone calls of all Americans every single day without the slightest bit of discrimination or targeting. There was just no conceivable argument that a government could ever make to me that would persuade me that that ought to be censored rather than disclosed. And so that was a story where I felt that there was almost no point in consulting the government unless they had something extremely surprising to say about what would happen from the disclosure of this program. And I think that that proved to be true. There has never been a single amount of harm that anyone has said came from the publication of that story. A federal court ruled the program that we reported was a violation of the constitutional rights of millions of Americans. And even President Obama now says that program should end.
You've done, you know, extraordinary work in breaking these stories, and it's having, enormous ripple effects. It seems to be leading to some reforms. Do you ever worry about unintended consequences?
You mean, I'm certainly aware that I can't anticipate the future. And when you're working with documents this complicated that affect, you know, potentially the lives of huge numbers of people, you know, certainly you can make wrong choices that end up having an impact that you don't want to have and don't intend to have. And it's definitely a burden to be in the position where you're making those choices or certainly involved centrally in the making of them. So sure, I'm very aware that there is that possibility. And that's one of the reasons why we have been as careful as I think we've been.
People within the national security system say that your reports are causing harm. They're compromising our safety. James Clapper, who's the director of national intelligence, he said that the disclosures have caused and continue to cause profound damage, and as a result, we've lost critical foreign intelligence collection sources. Richard Leggett, who is the deputy director of the NSA, said that the unconstrained disclosure of these capabilities means the targets see it and recognize it and move away from our ability to have insight into what they're doing, then we are at greater risk because we don't see the threat coming. Richard Clark, who is the first cybersecurity czar at the White House, said what Snowden did made us less safe as a nation. When you hear people who are insiders like that saying those things, do you just dismiss it?
Yes. And I'll tell you why. It's because I've looked at every single case over the last 50 years where whistleblowers have come forward and told the American people about things the government officials were doing that they didn't want anyone to know about, beginning with Daniel Ellsberg going through all sorts of disclosures on the war on terror and everything in between. And in every single case, every last one of them, government officials say exactly the same thing, which are the quotes that you just read. I mean, you should go back, or I don't mean you personally, but one should go back and look at what they said about Daniel Ellsberg, who I've talked to about this. And he said, there wasn't a day I woke up when I wasn't accused on major national television and in every newspaper of having blood on my hands, of being a traitor, of being reckless with people's safety and lives. They said the same thing about WikiLeaks, that they have blood on their hands. And McClatchy did an investigation and found that it was exaggerated and fictitious and untrue. There's not a single specific case in which our capabilities that are legitimate have been undermined, in which terrorists have learned anything they didn't already know, in which anyone has been injured or harmed as a result of our reporting. And the one thing I would hope is that people have learned by now after the Iraq war and everything else that before you believe the self-serving claims of national security state officials, that you demand that they present evidence for what they're saying rather than just believing it on faith.
You're in frequent contact with Snowden through secure channels, right?
Yes.
How is his mental and physical health holding up? I read him describe himself as a house cat, which I thought was hysterical, you know, that he's basically confined to wherever it is he's staying. So how's he doing?
One of the stunning things to me about this whole experience has been to watch him and maintain this extraordinary level of tranquility and contentedness about the choice that he made. You know, when we were in Hong Kong, the working assumption that we had, the three of us, myself, Laura, and Snowden, was that it would be a matter of weeks, if not days, until he was in American custody, and that the next time we would see him would be on television wearing an orange jumpsuit and shackles inside of a courtroom charged with espionage. And so for that not to have happened and for him to be free to participate in the debate that he helped galvanize around the world and to see how much reform it has led to and how much debate it has triggered, which is something that we were hoping for but didn't necessarily know would take place, has been incredibly gratifying. I mean, he told me recently that he's one of the rare people who gets to put his head on his pillow every night in the knowledge that he took self-sacrificing action in pursuit of his beliefs. And you're right, he is an inside cat, I think is what he called himself. But, you know, before the world knew him as Edward Snowden, he was somebody who spent a huge amount of time on the internet. He was one of those people who grew up with the internet. He's always spent a lot of time indoors online, which is how he developed the skills and capabilities that he had. He's sad to be away from his family. He's sad he can't come back to his home. He's sad to be in a country he didn't choose to be in and forced to remain there. But given the alternatives and given what it is that he produced in the world, I would say he's probably one of the happiest people I know.
Glenn Greenwald, thank you very much for talking with
us. Thank you. Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Glenn Greenwald speaking with Terry Gross last Wednesday. Greenwald's new book is called No Place to Hide: Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. Surveillance State. In 1954, the original Japanese film Godzilla was unleashed on the world. 60 years and many, many sequels later, a new American remake is opening in theaters. The new Godzilla is directed by Gareth Edwards and stars Bryan Cranston, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, and Elizabeth Olsen. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The 1954 Godzilla was released when the trauma of the A-bomb was fresh. Its title creature, an unholy fusion of reptile and radioactive automaton. In the original Japanese cut, not the American version that shoehorned in Raymond Burr as a reporter, it's the grimmest giant monster picture ever made, a vision of nuclear Armageddon that remains unrivaled. The new American Godzilla, on the other hand, is served sunny side up. Its finale is boffo, its message upbeat. I found that slant bewildering for all kinds of reasons, but I have to admit that the last 20 minutes rock. Not so much what comes before it, though. The first three quarters is choppy and withholding and packed with clichés. It opens in the Philippines, where a foreman leads scientists played by Ken Watanabe and Sally Hawkins into a vast radioactive cavern. "I've been digging holes for 30 years," he says. "I've never seen anything like it." Cut to a Japanese nuclear power plant, where engineer Bryan Cranston, under wavy dark hair, confronts strange seismic activity and tries to keep Juliette Binoche as his scientist wife from perishing when things go boom. 15 years later, Cranston is a fanatic, convinced the Japanese government is hiding something, something alive and about to bust out. His son, played by Aaron Taylor Johnson, is a military specialist trained in bomb dismantling, and he thinks his dad is nuts. But we know who's right. We've seen the previews. So we wait, eager to see if state-of-the-art computer-generated imagery will give us the Godzilla of our dreams. Director Gareth Edwards made a successful low-budget giant monster picture in 2010 with the generic title Monsters, in which he mostly kept the creatures off-screen. Godzilla has a much bigger budget, but holds to the strategy of less is more. On one level, that's refreshing. Too many modern effects movies throw everything at you, making miracles seem cheap. Edwards handles Godzilla's revelation like a striptease, one scaly green piece at a time. He does the same with two other monsters, nasty, spider-like creatures with flaming slits for eyes, and the endearing acronym MUTO for Massive Unidentified Terrestrial Organism. I don't think I'm spoiling anything by saying our weapons of mass destruction don't work on the MUTOs, and that the best hope to stop them from mating and making more MUTOs is Godzilla. Watanabe's scientist says as much to a military commander played by David Strathairn.
This alpha predator of yours, Doctor, do you really think he has a chance?
The arrogance of man is thinking nature is in our control, and not the other way around. Let them fight.
Those are wooden readings by Strathairn, and Watanabe isn't the life of the party either. Aaron Taylor Johnson is nominally the lead, but isn't up to his big scenes. Cranston isn't around long, and his hair is a distraction. No, it's all about the monsters, what there is of them. In the first encounter between Godzilla and the MUTO, the big lizard starts to give it to the big spider, and the director cuts to soldiers locking and loading. There are more soldiers, more people on the streets of San Francisco where the monsters face off, the camera dollying in on their goggle-eyed faces, a move cribbed from Steven Spielberg. I don't think I was alone in muttering, "Show us the money!" Finally, briefly, we get the monster brawl. And it's excellent. The climax is a rouser. I laughed, I cried, I cheered. And I felt a little taken aback. The original Godzilla was a cautionary tale. And in the big monster movies that followed in Japan and America, the invaders were emblems of humanity's arrogance. "We've poisoned the earth," the movies said, "and the earth has come back at us." But this Godzilla says explicitly that nature is self-correcting, that no matter what we do, a higher power will belch forth a savior. With so many threats to the planet, the timing is odd, don't you think? I know it's just a dumb genre picture, but even dumb genre pictures have a tradition of speaking to their era. In this one, the nuclear roar becomes a reassuring purr.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Coming up, comic Todd Barry discusses his new performance film documenting his crowd work tour, a series of stand-up shows with no prepared material where Barry relies solely on his banter with the crowd. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Louis C.K. has described our next guest, Todd Barry, as one of his favorite comedians. Barry's especially good at crowd work, interacting with members of his audience. Barry had the idea of filming a tour in which all he did was crowd work, all improvised, no script, and Louis C.K. decided to produce the film for his website. It's now the first work produced for and sold on the site featuring a comic other than Louis C.K. Todd Barry also plays a version of himself on Louis C.K.'s show Louis and was featured in the film The Wrestler. Barry's done a lot of voiceover work for animated TV series, in addition to releasing his own comedy albums. Terry spoke with him last Monday and began with a clip from the Crowdwork tour. The film follows his performances in seven cities. This is an excerpt of his performance in Portland.
I'm from Seattle, Washington.
Seattle, Washington? Holy
shit. Yeah. I came 200 miles to see you today.
Really? You know I'm doing the show there on Sunday, right?
I got to work that day.
You got to work?
Yeah.
Where are you working?
I work at the Naval Yard.
Naval Yard?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you in the military?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not the smartest guy. So that you're hitting me with a double whammy of guilt trip, aren't you? I'm in the military. Yeah, the military. And I drove 200 miles to see you. And I'm sitting up front. But hey, if you want to insult me, go ahead. If you need to insult someone who's in the military who drove 200 miles from Seattle, and I'm going to tell you the state, Washington. Seattle, that's huge, sir. Did you really come just for this show?
Yeah, just for you.
I yep. can't believe that.
That's it, yeah.
Did you get a hotel and do it that
nope,
way?
Nope, I got to drive home tonight, too.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That makes me uncomfortable. If you said you were getting a hotel, I'd be like, oh, he's just, you know, he's making a little trip. He's cool. He's like, drove 200 miles. Going to turn around and do it. Whenever this is done. I mean, after I talked to you at the merch table for 4 hours. Are you allowed to ask for days off?
Oh, yeah, but it's...
It's a bullshit excuse to get a day off. Hi, I was wondering if I have a name. What do you call your commanding officer?
Captain.
Captain, I got a request for it. Can I get Sunday off? Why, soldier? I don't know much about the military. Why is that, soldier? Todd Barry's doing an experimental show where he's just going to wing it. I would be a heartless man if I didn't give you the day off. Wait, is he doing a show in Portland? Why don't you drive there and back the same night?
That's Todd Barry from his new film, The Crowdwork Tour, which is on the Louis C.K. website. Todd Barry, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, I'm excited to be here.
So I'm listening to that part of your show, and I'm thinking, if I were on stage and somebody told me that they had driven 200 miles to hear me, my first reaction would be, oh, that was so nice of you. I'm so honored that you made the trip, that long a trip, just to hear me. But that wouldn't work for you in this show, would it?
No, that would be just the nice guy tour.
That's right.
But I was flattered that the guy... I mean, it always weirds me out when people do that, because I just feel like you spent 8 hours driving to see a show. I mean, it's probably something I would have done when I was younger. But I gently played with that guy a little bit, and he seemed to enjoy it.
Oh, he seemed to want it.
He wanted to be
in your show.
Yeah, he was front row center.
So what's it like to walk on stage having nothing? Do you know what I mean? Like, all you have is like your wits about you. You don't have any material you're going to use. Maybe you have some things planned because you know you're likely to talk to somebody who's a musician, and you're likely to talk to somebody who, I don't know, does social media or something. Do you have anything planned?
I don't really have anything planned. I mean, sometimes if I think of something like walking to the stage or when I'm walking around, I will say that. But I won't do any of my actual acts. What I'll do is I will look around for people who maybe are intriguing. Someone has an interesting look or seems friendly and welcoming. And then I kind of just go, does anyone want to talk to me? And they're surprisingly not as enthusiastic to do that. But once I kind of ease into it, then they kind of slowly warm up to it. But there are people who sit right up front who don't want to talk, even at like a crowd work show.
They're afraid you're going to insult them.
Yeah, and I don't think I'd want to sit up front at a comedy show, so I totally get that, but I try to be nice.
Handing over the microphone to the audience, did anyone use that as an opportunity to actually heckle you?
Well, one guy in Portland who I cut out, he just, I don't know, sometimes people, I think, they, because you're a comedian, they don't think they can just be real with you. They think that, oh man, this guy's waiting for me to say something really clever, which is never the case. And there was just some guy just sort of like insulting what I was wearing. He's like, why are you wearing like a gray shirt and a gray pant? Like it was just some weird insult, and he just had a nasty energy to him. So he did not make the final cut of the movie. But then he talked to me afterwards, and he was perfectly nice, so I don't know. I don't know what people are thinking when they're talking to me.
Well, I want to play another example of your comedy. That sounds really horrible. An example of your comedy.
I like it.
Here's another specimen of your comedy.
Yeah.
And this is from your most recent album. Let's hear it. This is my guest, Todd Barry.
I've been torn all over. Did a show in Missoula, Montana. Ordered a drink at the place I was working at. Ordered a gimlet, classic drink. Guy said he didn't know how to make it. Bartender next to him goes, oh, I can make that. I used to work at a gay video club. I was like, I don't even know what a gay video club is, but I'm pretty sure enough to work want to know how to make a gimlet. It's a 10,000-year-old drink with two ingredients in it. It's like, what's he want, gin and tonic? Oh, I can handle that. I used to work at a bisexual shuffleboard court. What do you ask for, rum and coke? I'll handle that one, Freddie. For many years, I refereed a transgender Scrabble tournament. You keep me posted on any more nutty drink orders that come in. With my life experiences, I can be your go-to guy for any two-ingredient beverage. What do you ask for? Vodka soda. Let me deal with that. After high school, I got a job supervising an S&M lawn crew.
That's Todd Barry from his...
I think I took that one punchline too many, but...
Do you? Why are you saying that?
I just forgot about the S&M lawn crew. I think I could have come up with something better than S&M lawn crew. But I do like to extend the joke as long as possible.
Right. Well, that's from Todd Barry's album, Super Crazy, which was released in 2012. So did you actually overhear a bartender saying that?
Yeah, that's a completely true story.
Really?
Yeah, he kind of, I was at a place in Missoula. It was my first show in Missoula or in Montana. And I asked for a gimlet, and he kind of like, I don't know how to make that. And the other guy was like, I got it. And then when he said, you know, because I worked at a gay video club, I just was like, oh, here, oh, it was just delightful.
So did you take out your notebook and write it down after that?
In the way that I do that, yeah, which is hopefully remember it and then write it down eventually.
So that works for you? Like you actually have a memory?
No, I don't. That's the problem with my writing discipline or lack of is that sometimes I'll take a note and I won't even understand what the note was. It'll just be like green shirt. And you're like, I don't even know what I'm remembering here because... But I did have a funny thought about a green shirt, but then it's gone.
So does most of your material come from actual observations?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be. Yeah, I don't get political. I don't get personal. Some people say I don't get funny, but not you.
How come you don't get personal on stage and you don't talk autobiographically?
I've just always been squeamish about that kind of thing. When I see guys, you know, talking about their sex lives and everything, I have done jokes about it, but it's just not my name. I guess I'm just kind of a close to the vest guy. Really mysterious and intriguing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is comic Todd Barry, and he has a new comedy show that's called the Crowdwork Tour Show, in which he just interacts with the audience. There's no written material. There's a documentary of him doing that show in several cities, and that film is available on Louis C.K.'s website. You and Louis C.K. are old friends, and he produced the comedy show that's now on his website of your crowd work tour. He cast you on his show, Louis, and I want you to describe the version of yourself that you play.
I kind of play, you know, a slightly heightened version of myself. You know, he'll, a lot of the banter he writes or the lines he writes are just really me telling him he's bad at comedy, which is something I will do from time to time. But he likes to insult people too, so. For me, though, it seems to be just nonstop assault of insulting him.
Is it odd playing yourself? Because you have to, I mean, it's still a performance, and you have to be probably a little bigger than you are when you're really just yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think I play it about at my energy level, but it's weird when he writes a script and, like, I remember a scene we were filming that's on the upcoming season where he had me say boom after, like, every sentence. And he, at some point, he goes, Todd, you don't want to say boom, do you? I just don't feel that I would in real life. Since I'm playing Todd Barry in this, I don't know that I would say boom after every sentence like this. So he let me not say it.
That's funny because in your crowd work tour show,
I do say boom.
You do say boom once, and then you almost like correct yourself. It's like, whoa,
I was hoping you wouldn't call
why
me
would
on
I
that,
use
yes,
that?
Sure.
No, but yeah. You're kind of like shocked at yourself and like disappointed in yourself, almost apologetic for using the word.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you're like, oh, I'm one of those guys who says boom? Yeah. I thought I was cooler than that.
So as a comic, you're on the road a lot, and there's a really funny scene in your crowd work tour in which you're in a hotel room explaining that you're kind of a germaphobe. So
yeah.
How do you live on the road if you're a germaphobe?
Well, luckily most hotels are cleaner than my apartment.
How do you live in your apartment then?
Yeah, I'd say most rock clubs are cleaner than my apartment. But it's not a big problem. You're actually the only time it is a problem is when I play a music venue, and sometimes you play these music venues and they're like, oh, this place has the worst bathroom in the history of bathrooms. And you kind of like, well, you know, you could fix that and have a different reputation. So you get into these disgusting bathroom situations. So that's always an issue where the bathroom is in the place I'm performing. But hotels, I feel pretty safe in hotels.
I don't know.
Unless I watch the housekeeper clean and then see her throw the pillows on the floor.
Right.
And I get upset.
So you don't think about, like, what's happened on the bedspread the day before I got here?
Yeah, I actually once got accused of, I'd stayed at a hotel in Chicago and there was a $100 charge on my credit card afterwards. And they're like, yeah, the bedspread was missing. And I was like, if there's anything I wouldn't steal in a hotel, I'm not going to steal anything. But I guarantee you, if I was a kleptomaniac, the bedspread is not going to be stuffed into my bag.
You actually have something very funny in one of your albums about being a germaphobe. So
right.
let's hear that. And this is from your 2012 album, Super Crazy.
A germaphobe. Also very lazy. It's a rough combination, lazy germaphobe. Because if the cleaning job's easy, like washing my hands, I do that compulsively like 500 times a day. But if it's more difficult, like mopping my floor, I've never done that. I was rationalizing that, hey, I've only been walking around the same floor for 10 years. How dirty can it be? It's not a cleaning emergency like that time I accidentally touched my pinky against my belt buckle. I had to walk out of a wedding where I was the best man. Paralyzing being a germaphobe. Lots of places are really paralyzing to me. Laundromats have these baskets on wheels. Some guy will come in with a big bag of disgusting laundry, put it in the basket, move it into the washer. Then I'm supposed to take my clean laundry out of the dryer, put it in that exact same basket. It's like, I don't mind something having a dual purpose, but can't be like, hey, what's that big green box over there? Well, that's a dumpster, and we also use that to store soup. Well, I think that might be an either-or situation.
That's my guest, Todd Barry, from his 2012 album, Super Crazy. And his latest work is a documentary of his comedy tour called The Crowdwork Tour. And that's on the Louis C.K. website. So can I ask you an awkward question? Have you ever been in a club where, like, the backstage doesn't have its own bathroom?
like this germaphobe thing, right?
No, that's not what this is about. So that you're using the bathroom with the people who have come to hear you. And so before you're on stage, you're in the bathroom with them. And then so how do you go from being the guy in the urinal next door to being like the guy on stage. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Is it awkward to be the stage self after you were?
I do. It's not so bad after the show.
Mm-hmm.
Then they can find out that I go to the bathroom sometimes. But I, before the show, I mean, that is one of the things where, like, the layout of the club is really something I wish I could control sometimes, where you're just like, where's the bathroom? Oh, you have to walk through the entire audience, and then it's to the left of the stage or something. You're like, is there a McDonald's around here or something? I don't want to necessarily talk to them before the show, because I do like to have this illusion of mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And mystique, and I just think it kills that a little. I mean, I'm always, when I go to see a show, a band or whatever, when the lights come down, that's probably my favorite part of the show. It's just the excitement of them walking on stage.
And what's the most nervous-making part of the show for you as a performer?
You mean a crowd work show or just any show?
Any show.
I tend to get nervous situationally. Like, if I go to a comedy club, you know, I'm probably going to be fairly comfortable on stage. If someone, like, hires me to do a party for businessmen or something, business people, and it's in a conference room in a Sheraton or something, but they're paying me so much that I can't say no, that's going to be a rough one. But it might go well, but it'll make me sick to my stomach the whole day.
And it's not necessarily your audience. These aren't people who came because you're performing. These are people who are there because somebody booked you at their convention.
Yeah, and quite often people who do that don't know how to put on a show. So it'll be like, all right, we're going to have mariachis come out for an hour and a half. Then we're going to serve cake. And as the cake's coming down, you're going to walk on stage. And then I have to go, no, they have to eat the cake. And then I go on stage. You have to sort of. I'm not going to follow mariachis and then cake. Like, there's no one can follow that.
Todd Barry, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Todd Barry speaking with Terry last Monday. Barry's new performance film, The Crowdwork Tour, is available on Louis C.K.'s website. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.